This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
My name is Bill Ayers, and I'm chairing this session. We have a session this morning that's, I think, really important and exciting. One of the strands that I think we're all living with is this question of abolition and how we move from, you know, a consciousness of the need for abolition of prisons into action, into actually creating an irresistible movement. And that's the big question that powers every time I sit down and think about or talk about abolition. How do we move from where we are, which is to say, everybody talks about the new Jim Crow. Everybody knows that the carceral system is a broken system, that it doesn't deliver even on what it says it wants to deliver on, which is community safety. It doesn't deliver on that at all. And so how do we move from good organizations, good projects, good people, good lawyers, good, you know, good journalists? How do we move from that to really building an irresistible social movement? So that's the question that bubbles underneath what we're about to hear. We're going to hear from four folks who are involved in prison abolition. We're going to hear from Alte Thompson, who is in a facility in Illinois called Graham Facility, which I'm afraid I don't know, but you may know, yeah. And he's been in for 29 years. He'll be coming to us through Sarah Wattar, who is here from the Civil Rights Corps, and we'll be talking about that really important work. And then two of my comrades from Chicago, Denzel Burke and Destiny Phillips, both founders of the Real Youth Initiative, which they'll give you much more information on. But I'm thrilled to have been asked to chair this session because of my deep, deep respect for the three of you and for the work you do. So with no further ado, we're going to go to Sarah.
Just making sure, is this on? It's okay. So hello, everybody. My name is Sarah. I work for Civil Rights Corps, and I'm just going to start us off with a couple of recordings that I have with Mr. Alte Thompson, who's currently incarcerated, as mentioned. He's been in the Graham facility. He's been incarcerated for 29 years, since he was 17 years old. I believe it was 1995, and he is still currently incarcerated there. So we've been doing some interviews over the phone. I also just like know him as a friend. I haven't known him that long, but we've gotten to know each other over the last couple months. And I got to ask him a lot about how incarceration is both isolating, but also through the prison conditions and obviously the prison industrial complex. He is separated from his family, his loved ones, and the dehumanization factors on a daily basis. So you'll hear that pop up in conversation with him. There is a chance, like we were hoping, that he'd be able to call at a specific time during this panel. However, they started locking them in on weekends about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we tried to see if we could get permission for him to be able to call at this specific time. But of course, that is not easy to do, nor is that welcomed. So he will try to call. If he does, I will answer, and we'll get to do an immediate sort of Q&A with him. But if that doesn't work out, that's also why I have the recordings with him. So yeah, I'm just going to start us off. One of the questions that I started with him was pretty much asking him just what he thinks is one of the most challenging aspects of incarceration. There are obviously many. So I'm going to let him tell us a little bit about that.
The most challenging part is just being recognized or being identified as a human being, as a person, because inside here is not something that you are normally look at a person and the first thing you say, oh, he's in jail. The first thing people think is the negatives, all the things, it's those connotations about incarceration that makes it challenging because, the one thing that I like to always say is that, I just want a person to know me and become for me with the person that I have become over the years, and understand that I am a human being. I'm a person who made a mistake in my life, and, I don't want to be seen or judged for that one mistake that I made in my life.
I then asked him, "Was that okay? Can you all hear it?" Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll turn it up a little bit too. But then I asked him a little bit about the significance of human connection and the loss of human connection, and he talks a little bit about that here.
Well, it's like the human touch. There's no such thing as that in jail. Us being people, as human beings, we are social creatures. We have to have that interaction with other human beings on a level where, when you meet your moms, you see your sister, your brother, there's a hug there, there's a peck on the cheek or something like that. When you are devoid of those type of feelings to where they'll show people that cares about you, it takes a lot from you mentally, and it's, to the point where it's like, if somebody just like right now, like if someone's to brush up past me, like, okay, what you touch me for? You don't want to be touched, and it shouldn't be that way because it was not intended by that, but it was just that this is how the system has conditioned us to feel, even like when you're talking to guards, if there's a female guard around, you have to be mindful of, that you're talking to a female guard, and you can't just like talk to like a human being, like, hey, how your life doing, this, you can't have that conversation like that. So, once you remove that element of connection, human connection from a person, it breaks a person down because you're taking a natural element within a person away from them.
So, he talks a little bit about human connection there, and I'd like to start with telling a little bit of a story about, I've never actually shared this publicly in a public space, so this is my first time talking about something that's personal, but or about this specific thing in my life. So my brother's been incarcerated for 3 years, and I remember right after his trial, the first thing obviously my family and I wanted to do was go and visit him, see him, hug him, make sure he's okay. And when we got to the county jail that he was at, the first thing that we realized was when they took us back to the visiting room, we were at screens. And we were confused by it because, honestly, it was all of our first time, my mom and I, my sister, my dad, our first time visiting a jail. And so we didn't really know what to expect other than what we'd seen on TV in different ways. So when we saw a screen and a stool in front of it, we were confused and we were thinking, what is this, a weird sort of fancy version of a jail that we're using screens or laptops or, genuinely really confused by it. And it turns out that these visits are all virtual. So even though we were in the physical jail that he was at, we were given a screen to talk to him through. And, we wait till the countdown, the screen is black. And then he pops up, and it's a really weird space that you're in because, the stool's, really low, the screen's a little bit up high. The stool is, bound to the ground, so you can't move it. So if you're a little bit short, like me, you can't even, see properly, you can't sit close enough. You also have a phone in your hand, right? So it's a video screen, phone, and then that's how we could talk. So my mom and I, it's only two at a time, my mom and I had to talk to him that way. And instantly, we're rushed with feelings of disappointment. We can't hug him. We can't make sure he's okay in that sort of, same space as him. And we realized that this was the way of this jail. And so, again, I'm thinking, okay, I guess this jail is like that. And we didn't really understand why. That first month, each time we'd drive out to see him, he's about 2.5 hours away. So we'd drive out to see him to have those visits. They're 20 minutes long. Then they told us, I think maybe a month later or so, they were going to start letting us do it at home. So then we start doing this at home where we can see him from there. And even that felt really weird because then we were like, well, now we're not even in the same physical space as him. And there was this weird instinct of wanting to go over there and still be in the space with him, even though we couldn't be with him. And my brother was like, no, don't waste that time driving. Just obviously do it from home. It was free. So we were like, okay, well, we'll keep doing it from home. About 2-3 months later, they start charging, right? So then they say, okay, it's going to cost this much to do it from home. And it was really expensive. It was, you know, you could do it either in 25 minutes or you could get a 55-minute one. And it was like anywhere between $12 to $22 for each video call, depending on if you pick the 20-minute or the 25-minute and 55-minute one. And the whole time that this is happening, there's glitches in the video screens, right? So you are dealing with inconsistent conversation. So he would freeze randomly. We would freeze. Sometimes it would just, the screen would go black, and we would pay for this, right? And if it went wrong, or if we lost a bunch of minutes, or sometimes they wouldn't even notify him that he had a call or even let him out to do his call. So he'd come in like 5 minutes late, and that didn't matter. So if you had paid for a 25-minute call and you lost 5 minutes of that, it didn't matter. They're not going to give that money back to you. Or if you really want to try that hard, you can call and try to figure it out on the phone, and everyone tells you that they're not responsible for it. So you're dealing with that. And so then, you know, if somebody's in that county jail, like my brother, who was there for 8 months before he was transferred over to the prison, that 8 months, we're not seeing him, we're not touching him, we're not hugging him. And that has that type of trauma, like, I will never forget. I will never forget the way my mom, so my family's Middle Eastern. I'm Arab, 100%. Both my parents are from Syria. And there's a word in Arabic, shabah, which means, like, ghost. And my mom, I remember she used that word to describe him a little bit. She was like, I'm starting to feel like he's not even in our world anymore. Like, he's not even there. He's starting to feel like I get, like, emotional.
That's intense.
Yeah, she said he's starting to feel like a shabah to me, like a ghost. Because, you know, we don't see him. We don't touch him. She's like, I can't smell him. I can't have him there with me. I can't hold him. And I just kept telling her, it's going to change. Like, just wait until he's in the prison and you'll have visits and this will be a memory. Like, you know, and I was just kind of constantly remind her of that. But his time there kept getting delayed because of everything gets delayed in courts, right, all the time. And so 8 months later, he's moved to the prison and we finally had our first in-person visit with him. And that feeling of hugging him, it honestly, like, I wouldn't even say it washed away, like, the 8 months of trauma of not seeing him, but it washed away that anxiety that we'd had for those 8 months just by simply hugging him, feeling him physically, like, you're okay, you're here, right? You're on this earth with us. And so that feeling I will never forget. In those 8 months, we were so desperate to just see him that he would describe to us what window he was in. Like from his cell, right? He could see, he would describe to us what he sees from his window, which part of the parking lot outside of it, and what cars he sees. And my mom and I would drive around trying to figure out what he sees in the parking lot and find that. And the windows are really dark, so we couldn't see him, but we saw his shadow. He was like, I think I'm up high. We didn't know what floor he was on. But we saw, I remember my mom and I were in the parking lot, and we see his shadow up in the window. And he's jumping up and down when he sees us wave. And so we just see his shadow, you know, jumping up and down like that. And I screamed. Wow. And my mom and I were so excited. Looking back, that feeling of excitement of just seeing him, and, you know, we started crying, jumping up and down, just so excited that, oh, we spotted him, right? We could see him. And so it's really interesting because then I was a teacher at the time. I was a high school English teacher. I'd been a teacher for 8 years. And I taught for one more year after my brother's trial. And as an English teacher, I always rooted my, I was a literature teacher. I would always root my lessons in social justice. Literature is all about social, cultural issues, right? Humanities. And so then after my brother's trial, teaching that, I still felt like I needed to do something else. And so I got my master's and then I got really lucky and started to work for Civil Rights Corps. And the first project that I am starting with that I got to start with Civil Rights Corps was about jail video and phone calls. And I remember instantly being like, the irony, you know, because I had felt such a hatred for these companies that were so awful, that were so expensive, charging us so much money for phone and video calls. And here I am put on this project where I get to fight that exact part of the system. I couldn't believe it. And we called it the Right to Hug Project. And the language just in that title, the Right to Hug, just resonated with me instantly. And I was immediately thinking back to that time. And so what we've done is our team of investigators, and one of my colleagues, Kayla over here, is also an investigator on this case. our investigators and attorneys started looking at, you know, this is not just a one jail issue. This is not an issue in one state. This is a problem across the country. And across the country, jails for the last over 10 years have been slowly eliminating in-person visitation and replacing it with very expensive phone and video calls. And these phone and video calls are horrible quality. They glitch. You don't get, again, like you don't get a refund when things go wrong. And this industry is huge. For example, the top two largest companies, Securus and GTL, they dominate over 80% of that industry. And in 2022 alone, they made approximately $1.2 billion in just that 1 year alone, just Securus and GTL. And that's through eliminating in-person visits so that people are forced to use phone and video calls so they cannot see them. And this is happening in jails across the country. So we started investigating, you know, which jails are doing that. And we determined that we would file two lawsuits in two counties in northern Michigan, in Flint and Port Huron. The counties are St. Clair and Genesee. And what was interesting about these two counties is one of them is what you would call more conservative. The other one's more supposedly progressive. The sheriff likes to call himself a progressive sheriff. He, you know, on the front tells the community that he is, you know, trying to make things better and whatever. But actually, he is the one that eliminated in-person visitation over 10 years ago. And so when we filed these lawsuits, as we were filing them, I should say, we were going up to Michigan and doing jail interviews and talking to people that were in these jails and trying to understand, you know, how this is impacting, how their inability to see their families and loved ones is impacting them and their families, right? Because this is not only criminalizing those who are in the jails, but also their family members. And obviously, a huge common theme that we found is a lot of these are parents. These are parents that are in the jails who have young children on the outside that are trying to see them. And if you're in jail for, you know, 8 months, 12 months, sometimes more, you're separated from your child for that long without ever getting access to hugging them or seeing them. And there is one program in Flint where they get to have a visit with their kids once every, like, I don't know, like one of the families that we work with, he got a visit with his he has nine children and his wife. They were able to do one in-person visit in his over 13 months that he was in the jail. If you take like a certain amount of classes with them, you're finally rewarded with a visit. And so he was doing all of those, but in that time period, he was only able to get one, right? So in over a year, he got one visit with his kids. And so when we would interview him and he tells us about that, we would go and then talk to the kids. And we really got to know these kids as well. And they all also describe this as really traumatizing because when they're really young, like some of his kids were 1 year old, 3 years old, five, seven, you know, all the way up to 18. Each of them are experiencing a different phase of their development. So if you've got a 1 or 2 year old, they're not able to sit on a video call or a phone call for any sort of either extended period of time or even a focused period of time. And so, you know, imagine trying as a father to connect with your 1 year old, 2 year old child over a video call. It's not happening. And even the same when it comes to his, like he has two teenage sons. For them, like one of them described himself, he's like, I'm shy. And, you know, even around my own siblings, like I'm not comfortable talking to my dad about things like that are really private, you know, in front of everybody else. And so he gets a little bit quieter. So I watched them do a video call with their dad, you know, and they're all like trying to get time with their dad. And so none of them really end up getting much time with their dad, right? And their his 18-year-old daughter, you know, she talks about how, well, I know that these video calls are recorded. And so I'm not going to talk to him about the private things that I'm experiencing because I think it's creepy that somebody can watch this or listen to what I'm saying. And she's like, as an 18-year-old, 17-year-old girl, like I have things I want to tell my dad and talk to him about, and I can't do that because both phone calls and video calls are recorded. And so there is no access, there's no private access that she has to her dad. And so that was, you know, that was something that really stuck with us. And so we ended up having the majority of our plaintiffs in the cases be children. So the two lawsuits that we filed, the majority of our plaintiffs are kids. And these kids are arguing that they have a right to hug, a fundamental right to family integrity, a right to hug their parents. So they and then their parents as well, we did have a couple of plaintiffs who are parents who have their sons or daughters that are in the jail. also arguing that as a parent, right, my son or daughter, adult son or daughter, is in the jail. Me being a parent, that role, that responsibility, that sense of care doesn't just disappear just because they're an adult or in jail. I still feel a sense of, I need to check on my son. One of the moms, who's our plaintiff, her son had been in the jail for a while. And, you know, she was like, I will fight like hell to just have a chance to see my son and make sure that he's okay. So these are the plaintiffs that we have in these cases. And, of course, the jails will argue, there is no right, actually. They come back in the court and they say there is no fundamental right to visitation for families. We're trying to establish case law in Michigan and then further across the country that there is a fundamental right, a constitutional right to family integrity. And so that's kind of what we're working with right now. The companies relinquished responsibility. I will share that after this went public, we did get a lot of publicity about this. There, if you Google like Right to Hog or Genesee or St. Clair County, or even our website is over here and has the different stories about it. There's been a really great piece by Sarah Stillman in The New Yorker about it. And and there's a Teen Vogue article that we got to ghostwrite with one of our 12, 13-year-old plaintiffs about her dad. And so because of this publicity, Lester Holt from NBC ended up doing an interview with the sheriff of, and some others, but with the sheriff of Genesee County. If you want to watch that too, it's fascinating, really? Because he cornered the sheriff, and the sheriff admits on national television that when he asks him, you know, why did you do this back then, 10 years ago, why did you eliminate in-person visitation? And just like that, the sheriff answers, money. And you hear that from him, and you're like, wow, okay, there we go. We knew that, right? We know that. But to hear him say that, and because he pretends, I'm sorry, he is progressive. No, he pretends to be progressive. He's now publicly being cornered into answering to this. And so he actually announced on TV in that interview that they were going to, he was like, well, we're going to be, reinstating in-person visitation. I'm a different man now. I've changed. I understand. I've learned, right? Now, of course, on TV, that looks great. But in reality, we knew, like, there is going to be some more coming after that. And indeed, you know, they have been slowly reinstating in-person visitation. But it was like, okay, we're going to give it to this age group, for one day a week or once a month without their guardians. So, like, a kid can visit their parents, but they have to go in with, like, police or, you know, guards or security, which there's a whole lot of issues with that, right? CPS and all these other things. But, you know, we're working on that, and these lawsuits are currently pending. We're working in it. But yeah, I'm going to hand this over to our other panelists to talk a little bit about also family separation through incarceration.
Hello, hello. Does this work? Can y'all hear me? Thank you, Sarah, and also Bill for setting that up. And I just want to say, like, I really appreciate you sharing that story, and also Alte for sharing his experience as well. I have direct lived experience incarcerated from age 15 to 20. I did 5 years in, like, different juvenile and adult facilities in Chicago, and also, like, Racine, Wisconsin. So when I was in, actually, Racine, not to start off, because I want to talk about the organization as well, but this was, like, when I first got locked up, and I was, like, just turned 15, and I was locked up, like, out of town, and they didn't know where to place me, so they put me in, like, this county jail, and then I was, like, in this intake pod for, like, 2-3 days, like, going crazy. I'm, like, am I supposed to speak to somebody? Like, what time is it? Just this, like, reflection of yourself, and I'm, like, here with other, like, men, but they're, like, in their own cells or whatever, like, in this holding cell area. And then they, like, came and got me, and they're like, okay, you got to go upstairs. And I was like, aren't y'all going to send me back to Chicago? And they're like, not yet. Like, you got to go on tier. And I'm like, isn't this a dope facility? I'm like, where's the juvenile facility? And they're like, that's what they told us to do. It's just my job. So they sent me upstairs, and I, like, go upstairs on the tier, and, like, everybody comes in, and they're like, what the fuck is, like, is this a kid in, like, jail, like, with all us? And they're like, this is what we got to do. So they threw me in there and shit, and they told me, like, my cell. And then I went there, I see my cellie and shit. He's, like, 20-something. He's, like, 27. I'm, like, 15. And I'm like, this is probably like wrong, but I'm like, shit, like what can I, like I don't even know who to reach out, like there's somebody come talk to me about this situation. But one of the vivid things I remember about that, and one thing I will say though, like about that, was that once everybody seen that I was like a kid, like the whole pod was like, we're gonna make sure you're good, like protect you, like you don't got nothing to worry about. And like everybody really stood on that, and like I had no issues, even though I wanted to, so I could have something to hold the, you know, jail responsible for, to try to take them down in any way. But I remember my mom, you know, being from Chicago, she doesn't have a car, end up hitching like a ride with somebody I used to do like maybe a program with, and they're like, you know, I'll take you out there to go see your son. So they drive all the way out there, and my mom comes to visit me, and then they say she can't see me because they got to process her ID for like 24 to 48 hours. And then when I went on tier, I remember my first time like ever being locked up, I was in an adult jail, and they put me on max cuts, like they put me on the top floor on max, like you don't leave for anything, like all your windows are netted, like it's just super crazy. And I remember like just having this little box on the wall, and I'm like, what's that? And they're like, this is how we do visits. And I'm like, damn, like I can't touch even my mom. So they're like, nope. And she drove all the way out there, and then they still said she couldn't see me. And I'm like, oh, this is like messed up. And then, you know, I just want to highlight that point, because it like that full circle effect where you even talking about like and even, you know, Martin Sostre, a famous political prisoner, used to mention too, like how jails are so designed to like make everything hard for you to just, you know, do, like, you know, put a partition or a glass wall or speak through a phone. Like we've seen movies, you know how all the complex ways to do it, make the seat a little lower and the speaking thing a little higher so you can only listen at one time and then speak, and then they got to put their ear so they can't like have a, you know, a real connection with you. And I just wanted to share that piece because, like, you know, that's like a part of who I am and like the work that I do now. So fast forward to today, I'm one of the co-founders of Real Youth Initiative. It's an organization founded by me and Destiny in a juvenile prison after we met, really based around building revolutionary and political education with young people incarcerated under the nose of the state. So like we're more of a mentoring group to get in, and we go inside and hold political education workshops, teach about everything, you know, international aspect of an importance to like why, where prison is today, how officers, CPD get trained up by IDF, like all of that matters, right? And we like talk about that explicitly in our programs, and we think it's important because like we're working with young people who like obviously understand it. It's amazing to like, you know, have had access to books, read about George Jackson and him understanding that like his first resistance against society that he sees is like really terrible is crime, and like me finding myself in there and being like, and I'm sorry to like, you know, take it because I want to share the space with you and Destiny. That's why we're a good team. She'll like always know when to like tag me in. But it's important to speak about that because like a lot of young people, especially in Chicago, all over, like really internalize and be like, this is all on me. And it's like, no, like society has put you here and like you play the cards that you were dealt. But now with this understanding our history, our purpose now, our new sense of purpose, like we're unstoppable. You know what I mean? Like we got folks who like been through like the mud and like been through a lot of stuff and like are now linking things together, understanding Securus and GT. I remember first going to like St. Charles, one of the oldest, you know, juvenile prisons in Illinois, going down there my first time, literally like $5 for like a 15-minute call, and like having to like tell my mom like, hey, this week I'm low-key hungry, can you like put money on my books rather than talk to me this week, even though I love talking to my mom. And then you have visits every, you know, 2 weeks or whatever, and then we have to get into jumpsuits. So like when my mom sees me and stuff, it's like in this blue jumpsuit, and it's just really weird. But yeah, I definitely wanted to highlight even the importance, and I'll borrow a little bit from the analysis Dr. Orasami Burden had made in Tip of the Spear, where he talks about like prison being a battlefront, warfare, psychological, physical, and the need for all of us to like realize that and folks inside so that we can mobilize and move effectively in that manner. Because the going out to the parking lot and seeing him build morale for him, maybe people on his unit, where we don't even know that like that's a fight, you know what I mean, that like we can do. We can mobilize court support, we can mobilize people just coming out to the lot. I remember my family used to do that for me, and then you'd be like, where you at? And we don't know where we're at, and then we see each other and we're like, that makes you like, when you're locked up, they just like boost you for a month, right? So we can get down to studying, knowing that like we're in rooms and places built, you know what I mean? Like in the Audi home, we spent, you know, destiny like two, like together almost like 4 or 5 years almost, down the street, you know what I'm saying? 1100 South Hamilton. The room is constructed like a little box, you know, brick wall, you can almost reach, and I'm super short, right? I can almost reach wall to wall with my arms, like this way. This side is like a little longer. You got a toilet, your bed, and that's it. They don't give you a desk. They don't give you a pen. If you get caught with three books, and they're like, you only got two, you have to serve time in your room and get in trouble. You might lose restrictions and privilege. I mean, like a book. Like, I might have a notebook. I might want to, you name it. But I'll pass it off to Destiny, too, to, like, you know, introduce yourself.
Hi, everybody. My name is Destiny Phillips. I am also one of the co-founders of Brave Initiative. I'm 25 years old. I was born and raised in Chicago, of course. And a lot of what I want to talk about is, because they covered a lot, right? But it's still so much that hasn't been talked about that we can talk about, sit here and talk about in depth all day, right? But one of the things that stood out to me in talking about, exploitation, these systems capitalizing off us and, taking away our humanity. I can remember when I first got incarcerated and I went to 1100 South Hamilton, I actually served 4 years at that facility. So from 2014 to 2019. But when I first went in, it was just like so many black and brown bodies, right? And some I knew, some I didn't. And it just made me realize, coming from a place where, like, being in out in the community or going to high school, just living your normal life, right, where you don't know nothing about jails or prisons or anything, but then when you get locked up, you see, like, friends that you haven't seen in months and years, you're like, dang, this is where y'all been, like, held captive all this time, or, and even to, like, reconnect with friends and even family members. That's a different type of connection as well. But going through the system, I would say, like what Denzel said, I thought it was okay for them to do the things that they were doing, right? Until I joined this organization, Wild Inside and Free Right. And a lot of what Free Right used to do, they used to do a lot of abolitionist work as well. They used to have books, they used to have different types of scenes we can look at. And one day I was given a zine by one of the staff members that I read, and I was probably like 18 at this time, but I had been with this organization, and it was a zine about, revolutionary consciousness, and that's how I got introduced to, like, abolitionists, being abolitionists. I kind of woke up, and things started to make sense, and then I started going back asking questions, like, so, like, we're not supposed to get treated like this. We're supposed to have, a certain amount of time on our own. Like, even now, since I've been home, I know ACLU has sued the juvenile for having them, in their rooms for too long and not providing them with programs, basic necessities. They might come out of their room to shower or get a 30-minute phone call, but, when I was there, we had to fight for, I had to fight for a lot of the things that I didn't even realize until now. And then even going to, so it's only one female facility in Illinois that you can go to once you get your time, which is IYC Moorville, and that's why I met Denzel. And I had been seeing Denzel throughout the Audi home, but there's no contact. Like, we're not allowed to even communicate with the guys, and that's another dehumanizing thing as well, which makes it hard when you get out as a female, and even as a male, like, when you come home, it's hard to even, just communicate with the opposite sex, because for so long you're told, like, you can't talk to them, you can't touch them, you can't do any of those things, right? And it makes it weird. A lot of the external was out there too, like, being in for so long and all the rules and things that they come up with makes you feel like when you come home, it makes you shy, it makes you standoffish, it makes you, you gotta build that those things back up and, just fight through it. But, yeah.
Yes. Let's hear it. Great.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.